WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Vernell Bonnaries, opened on Broadway this week in a revival of One Mo' Time, which he also created and directed. It's a review that pays tribute to Black vaudeville of the 1920s. It's set in 1927 at the Lyric Theater in New Orleans. Bonnaries first staged One Mo' Time in 1979 in Manhattan. It ran for 3.5 years and toured the country. It was followed by the sequel, Further Mo'. Bonnaries also appeared in the films Down by Law and Pennies from Heaven. We were proud to feature him in two of the programs in our series on American popular song. I spoke with Vernell Bonnaries in 2000 when he was starring in the Prince Music Theater production of the Harold Arlen musical St. Louis Woman. Before we hear that interview, let's hear an excerpt of his 1992 Fresh Air appearance in which he performed excerpts of Jelly Roll, his tribute to Jelly Roll Morton, the composer, pianist, and singer who was one of the key figures in early jazz. Jelly Roll won an Obie Award and an Outer Critics Circle Award. We'll hear Morton Gunnar Larson at the piano.
Anytime you hear anybody playing jazz, what they playing is Jelly Roll. Now, I never got the credit for it, or the cash for that matter, but believe me, it's Jelly Roll. In foreign lands across the sea, they knight a man for bravery. Make him a duke or a count, you see, must be a member of the royalty. Mr. Jelly played a jazzy thing in the temple by the queen and king. All at once he struck upon a harmonic chord. The king said, make Mr. Jelly a lord. He's Mr. Jelly Lord, simply royal at the old keyboard. You should see him strolling down the street. The man's an angel with great big feet. With his melodies, they've made him Lord of the Ivories. Now at home, as well as abroad, they call him Mr. Jelly Lord. Now, you may be thinking that it might be a bit egotistical of me naming a song after myself. But really, now, anybody who was anybody in the city of New Orleans at that time, they had a song named after them. Usually for heroic reasons, people held high in the minds of their fellow citizens. Not all the time, though. Some people had songs named after them for quite a different reason. A perfect example is a guy I used to play pool with. I couldn't have been no more than 16, 17 years old at the time. Now, he had a song named after him because he was no doubt one of the most heartless men I have ever met. I didn't know it at the time, or else I never would have been playing pool with him. And I certainly would have never beat him at it. But he used to like to play pool with me because he knew that all the piano players at the different bordellos always had plenty cash money. And I was no exception. I'd walk up to the table, throw down my wad and say, okay, stand back with your little fives and tens and give my 50s here a chance to breathe. That's what I would say, showing off in front of him. Little did I know that the man I was talking to was Aaron Harris. The man already had 11 killings to his name. Aaron Harris is a bad, bad man. Aaron Harris is a bad bad man. Now he's the baddest man ever was on this land. I tell you, between people like Aaron Harris and Hoodoo and the racial prejudice that existed in New Orleans at that time, I found that I had to leave the city where I was born and raised and had truly come to love in my heart.
Vernell Bonnaries with Morten Gunnar Larsen at the piano, performing an excerpt of the review Jelly Roll, a tribute to Jelly Roll Morton. That excerpt was recorded on Fresh Air in 1992. Bonnaries is now on Broadway, starring in a revival of his review One Mo' Time. Here's the interview we recorded in 2000. Now, Vernell, your own productions have focused on early jazz and vaudeville, music from the earlier part of the 20th century. Why do you gravitate to that era? Is it music that you heard a lot when you were growing up, or something you developed a taste for later?
Well, I think that it's sort of the richest soup. That it's where everything sort of grew from, the fertile soil. And for me, I just find a great respect for the composers, for the performers at that time. I mean, they were really breaking ground, and it was an exciting moment. And people always refer to the Harlem Renaissance in the 20s and know about the literature of it. But there was a Renaissance period at that point because there was so much defiance and self-respect being built and pride. And I can feel all of that in the music. And the music was a popular music of that time. So they were really in the swing. It wasn't about nostalgia or whatever. And I think also coming from New Orleans, which is the hotbed of jazz and the birthplace, you just go to the real source.
What did you hear growing up in New Orleans?
Oh, I heard... From a child, I heard the real bottom-line traditional New Orleans music, the brass bands in the streets for funerals, and then we had the party bands for christenings and birthday parties, and people who are now thought of as the legendary founders of the music were people who were playing at that time. And they were older men at that point when I was a kid, but they were still there.
I've never been any place where there's been like a funeral brass band.
Uh-huh.
So to me, you know, when there's a funeral, it's a hearse and a lot of cars going by with their lights on, and it's a really somber occasion. And when you see the funeral procession going by, you just kind of stop and get this chill for a few seconds, even when you don't know the people at all. Mm-hmm. What's it like for you growing up when a brass band would march by playing this great music because there was a funeral?
Well, you realize that it's a celebration of the release of the person from the miseries that life can present if you're African-American living in a segregated southern city. And so it's a party. They've graduated, and they're brought to all the places that they help to make a happy spot. Corner bars and different friends' houses. They're passed in front of it, and sort of a last goodbye and a congratulations that you graduated.
Now, one of the musicals you're well known for is One Mo' Time, which was meant to be like a revival of a night at the Lyric Theater in 1926. Mm-hmm. And this is what you might have seen on stage there. Mm-hmm. So you do a lot of songs from the 20s. Songs, I think, perhaps that are even earlier
they're all
from the 20s?
Pretty much the 20s.
Okay. And what are some of the period issues that you had to deal with in doing that show?
Well, I did interviews with people who were still around
and had been to that very theater, to the Lyric Theater, and people who had experienced the TOBA circuit.
That's the Theater Owners Booking Association, yeah. Which was alternately known as Tough on Black Asses.
Yes. And
it was like the vaudeville circuit for African Americans.
Yeah, definitely. Some of the issues that I dealt with was the idea of somebody coming in on a in the colored section of the train, which had to be second only to the cows and the mules, and then getting off the train and not being able to find a hotel because blacks weren't allowed in hotels. And so they had to get to a guest house or something across the tracks where they could stay. And then they come in with this beat-up suitcase, and out of it comes a gown or a suit. And then they hit center stage and become a star. And I think that that's incredible, because part of the whole pumping up of getting to that stage and being there is a treatment that you can receive at the hotel, in the restaurant, whatever. And they got nothing of it, and they were still able to get out there on center stage in a follow spot and hit it and give everything they had. And Bessie Smith could not get into a restaurant, eat afterwards, after a show. And yet that didn't stop them, because they knew they had something to offer. They had talent. They had spirit. They used the performances to say things that they couldn't say, because there were laws that no more than six blacks could gather in one place at one time without being considered a mob. And so they were, and in church they couldn't say certain things as a community. So they used this space to have social messages, to communicate respect to each other as a unit, to build each other's self-respect. And all those things I tried to add in through the structure of vaudeville jokes. How come we always got to stay at a place where hot and cold water means hot in the summer and cold in the winter? You know, they're complaining, but it's not the black defiance as much as it is through the structure of the black vaudeville joke, the way vaudevillians would treat material.
Well, I happen to have the original cast recording queued up.
Oh, okay.
Why don't we hear you singing Cakewalking Babies from the original cast recording of One More Time.
Okay.
Introduce the song for us.
Cakewalking Babies. It goes back, Cakewalking Babies goes back actually to an earlier period of the cakewalk being a number that slaves would use to make fun of the manners of the white owners. And then it became a vaudeville number. This one, by the time it hit the 20s, this is actually just a number.
Okay, so here's the number.
Okay.
Cakewalking Babies, sung by my guest, Vernell Bonnaries.
Cakewalkers may come, cakewalkers may go, but I want to tell y'all about this couple I know. They high-stepping gals and debonair. When it comes to business, not a soul can compare.
Here they come.
Well, here they come.
Look at them down the stairs, going some.
They going some.
Look at them sink a bit, stuck of the town. Easing around, picking them up and laying them down. Dancing fool.
They dancing fool.
That's what they like to call them.
They're in a class of their own.
The only way for them to lose is to cheat out. You may try, but you never beat them. Stretch your stuff.
I struck the stuff.
They don't do nothing different.
The cakewalking babies from home.
Cakewalking Babies from the original cast recording of One More Time, which was written, directed, and starred my guest Vernell Bonnaries. And sorry for the couple of scratches you heard there. In my defense, I'll say this has not been reissued on CD. And it's from the recordings from the early 80s.
I must tell you, Terry, that One More Time, in its glory right now, you know, it's a hit musical and blah, blah. But we started it on $500. in my living room.
Performing in your living room?
We were rehearsing it in the living room, and the band was in the kitchen. And we opened for one night only in New Orleans on $500 to get together the set and the costumes. And to see that growth is just amazing. We wound up with 7 touring companies of it and a Royal Command performance for the Queen in London and the West End run. And just amazing what a dream can become.
We're listening to an interview with Vernell Bonnaries. He's now starring on Broadway in a revival of his Revue, One More Time. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Vernell Bonnaries, recorded in 2000. He's now on Broadway, starring in a revival of his Revue, One More Time, a tribute to Black vaudeville of the 1920s. I want to hear a little bit about your life, Vernell. Tell me a little bit about your family. You're from a Creole family?
Yeah, Creole family in New Orleans.
What does that mean exactly?
Creole in New Orleans means part Black, French, Spanish, and American Indian. It's sort of a four-part thing. And we had our own culture, in a sense. There was a lot of literary people that came out of it. They had their own language, Creole French.
You speak it?
No, my father did, but they used it as an adult language.
Oh, kind of like Yiddish and Jewish houses.
Yeah.
So the kids don't hear.
The kids don't hear you, right. And that's unfortunate. But certainly people know the food, which to me was sort of everyday cooking.
Tell us something more about your parents and their parents.
Well, my mother's name is Gloria Maria Diaz. And so obviously her side is Spanish-oriented. My father was, until last year, Lawrence Bonnaries from the French side of it. And they were very, very, I mean, the values are extremely based in Roman Catholic tradition. And it's extremely family-oriented society, your uncles and your aunts, and the idea that everybody sort of pitched together. There was no such thing as you could have and the person down the block didn't. It was a very open, giving sort of environment that I grew up in.
What was your attitude toward different ethnic groups, considering how many ethnic groups were in your family alone?
Well, that was the thing. There were so many ethnic groups that you couldn't have a prejudice. My grandmother, for example, my father's mother, was literally from Toulon, France. She spoke only French. She was white. And my father's father was from Haiti. And so he was part Black and he also spoke French. So they moved into this Creole area. And they felt comfortable there.
There was no... Creoles were not... They were light-skinned for the most part, but they were not forgiven as far as racial prejudice was concerned. I remember as a child drinking from a colored water fountain, and we always understood that our Black blood was first. We were completely open to white, Black. It just didn't matter because they may be your cousin.
Right.
And people chose, sometimes strictly for financial reasons. I remember my aunt, who's still alive in California, she and her sisters would go to work every morning. There was 4 of them. And 3 of them would go across the street to a colored cigar rolling factory. They rolled cigars. And she would go across the street to the white one because she made $2 more an hour. And she thought, well, I'm going to go for the money. But on the way home, they'd all get on the same streetcar and get back home. Huh. And it was a choice you made if you wanted to have that pressure in your life of trying to pass. You went on and did that if it made more financial sense for you. Or if you didn't, you didn't.
Do you have people in your family who passed?
Yeah. And some actually went to the point of sort of distancing themselves from the family. I remember at my grandmother's funeral, my father was furious because his two older brothers came to the funeral, and he'd always thought that they had passed for white and left and never really communicated with the family. But actually, they were products of her first marriage to a white guy, and they were white.
It's confusing, isn't it?
So he had to refigure once they told him the real story of it, because he just thought that they were brothers who had passed.
Vernell Bonnaries recorded in 2000. He's currently on Broadway, starring in a revival of his revue One More Time. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.